There we go. You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. Many thanks to PJ Brain for helping me get the radio station back on the air. Okie dokie. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and patient readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you will hear an interview with Gary Lee Miller, a Vermont author and jack of many interesting trades, who may in fact be conducting some interviews for Write the Book in the near future. And I will talk more about that after the show. Gary Lee Miller is the creative director of Writers for Recovery, a series of writers' workshops helping people overcome addiction. His fiction has been published in a number of national literary magazines, including the Chicago Quarterly Review, the Florida Review, and Washington Square. His short story collection, Museum of the Americas, was published in 2014 by Burlington, Vermont indie publisher Fomite Press. Gary Lee Miller occasionally writes about music for 7 Days, Vermont's weekly arts and culture newspaper. He also does a lot of writing for kids, covering everything from burrowing owls to robotic dinosaurs, wireless technology to wolves, and interviewing stunt pilots, civil rights pioneers, oceanographers, and rocket scientists. Gary has co-produced 2 documentary films and has been nominated for a New England Emmy Award for documentary script writing at WGBH PSB Boston. He has won Best Educational Project Award from the Massachusetts Interactive Multimedia Council. He's been nominated for a Pushcart Prize in Fiction. And he has been a finalist in the James Jones Novel Fellowship Contest. When he's not writing, you can find him kayaking or fly fishing on the rivers of Vermont, unless, as he says on his bio, it's too cold. When I spoke with Gary Lee Miller last week, I asked him to start by reading from the title story of his collection, Museum of the Americas.
The Museum of the Americas hasn't had 5 visitors a month since 1973, when they put the interstate through and left this part of the upper valley like a rock in the river that's too far to reach from shore. Admission is $3, which doesn't add up to much. I live off the money Dad left from the museum's glory years and try to run the place the way he would have if he were still alive. Dad was a master of the tourist business, and I hold hard to his principles, because that's what he taught me, the one of his 2 sons who wanted to learn. Once every few weeks in the summer, visitors stop by, people who remember the museum from the years before, or who make a wrong turn and decide to take a look before wheeling around in the gravel and dirt parking lot and moving on to where they'd intended to go. A couple pulled in last Thursday, the hottest, driest day of the year, in an old clay-colored Chevy wagon with Illinois plates and a little blue and white Scotty camper tagging behind. The woman drove, which seemed funny for people my age, better than 70 and with their best years behind them. She pulled the little rig into the museum lot and it petered to a stop, barely stirring dust. "What kind of exhibits do you have here, mister?" she said. Her voice was firm and honest, and I couldn't help but like it, try as I did not to. I could have answered as simple as she asked, but that's not the way in roadside attractions. "Soil," I said, just like Dad would have, a little hum in my voice, a little shill. "We got soil from Tierra del Fuego to Tierra del Alaska and all the Americas in between." I smiled to give her that welcome feeling. The man slept leaning up against the window, and she tapped him on the arm. "We're here," she said, as if they came here on purpose instead of by accident. This got me to thinking about the old days, before the interstate spoiled it all.
Very good. Thank you for reading that.
You're welcome.
So I wonder if you can talk about this collection first, before we get into the specifics of that particular story. So when did you write these stories, and how did you decide to turn them into a book, and when did that all happen?
The stories were written over a long period of time. I think I was, you know, I'd written some of them even before I went to Vermont College back in the 90s. And it took a long time for them to come together as a collection. A lot of the reason for that was that I was mostly focused on writing novels. And I wrote 2 novels in the late 90s and early aughts. And, you know, I got an agent who said, you know, there's going to be a happy ending to this story. And I waited a long time. And there was not a happy ending to that story. And so kind of while working on other you know, trying to move another novel forward, I just decided, maybe I could put a collection together, because I have a lot of stories, and a lot of them have already been published, which means, you know, at least some people think they merit publication. And so I put a collection together and ended up finding a publisher, and it was a happy ending to that story.
To that story, but the agent had nothing to do with it, and there should be a place for agents like that all go to the same place.
No, that's all right. I understand, you know, an agent's trying to do a really hard job with work that's like mine. I understand that I'm not writing, you know, a big thriller bestseller. I'm writing a literary novel, and, you know, one of the ones he had was a historical novel to boot, which they're just really hard to sell. Mm. And, you know, maybe I could have done a better job. I mean, I guess I could have, you know.
I guess I'm referring more to the hope that's raised and the promises that are made implied. It's just hard.
I have to tell you, it was very hard.
It is.
Now, I'm an optimistic person, and, it was about 2 years that it all played out. And I came home every single day. This was in the days of message machines. And I came home every single day sure that message was going to be on the thing saying, you know, on the machine saying, I just sold your book.
Right.
And
right.
So, yeah, it was hard.
Yeah. Were there stories that you had written that you almost put in the collection and decided not to? Were these really the clear-cut ones that you wanted to include?
Yeah, these were the clear-cut ones. And I think the only one that probably... was there one there were a couple that came along later that, you know, kind of just made it under the gun. I think there was one that came between the time that the collection was accepted for publication and publication.
Yeah.
And I sent it to them. They said, oh, yeah, let's put this one in there, too. So,
I'm going to ask you later about your experience with getting published or your experience with this press.
Sure.
First, I want to talk a little bit about the story, the title story, Museum of the Americas, from which you just read a page and a bit. It's so unique. It's a story about a museum that collects soil samples from around the American continent. Early in the story, there's some history about how it used to actually have other things too, but it became about soil. And so, anyway, it's so unique. So, how did you come to this story?
Well, when I first came to Vermont, I mean, I've lived here since 2000, but I came here before that in the 90s to go to Vermont College. And the first time I came up here, I decided that I didn't want to drive on the interstate, because I wanted to see what Vermont was all about. And so...
Where were you coming from?
I was coming from Boston.
Okay.
And so when I got to kind of the Vermont border, I switched over to the back roads. And I believe it's Route 14 that comes up from kind of West Lebanon, New Hampshire, mm-hmm. and then up, you know, up into Barry somehow. And I was driving down or up that road toward Vermont College, just, you know, checking out the scenery. And I came around the corner and I saw this kind of house, and beside it was a low-slung yellow building with a cupola on top, and in front of the house was a couple old 40s-era junk cars and a sign that said Museum of the Americas. Huh. And I thought, wow. And it just seemed so, you know, preposterous, you know, this would be the place for the, quote, Museum of the Americas. And I made I made two promises to myself at that moment. One was that I would never go inside that museum to find out what was in there. And two was that I would make it up and write a story about it.
Okay, that's...
And actually, the museum is now closed. It's been decommissioned. The things that, whatever was in it was sold. And I've actually met people who said, oh, I know what was in that. And I say, don't tell me. I never want to know. You know, I made it up. And it took a long time. It probably took 5 or 6 years until the idea, you know, not like 24 hours a day feverishly trying to think of an idea, but, right. you know, just perking it around in my head and working on my novels and whatever, and I came up with this idea of a soil museum.
Yeah. I think that's sort of the perfect metaphor for writing prompts, which is sort of you get something that gets you started, but you don't want to be given the whole idea. You just
right.
want to get started and then let your imagination take hold of it and run with it.
Right. Yeah. I haven't written a lot of nonfiction, and I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, is it's not fun for me when everything's already there for you to, and you just kind of have to talk about what's there for anyone to see. I want to try to make it up.
So I found the history of the museum and its curator so wonderful and kind of sad also. And not that he's a sad person, but his history is a little bit sad. There's a relationship that he has with his brother when he's a young boy. And the narrator refers to himself as having been the good boy, and his brother was the bad boy. But really all he was doing was making bad choices with a good heart for the most part, certainly early on, and you'd get in trouble for it. And there's this tension that gets set up early on because the two brothers are both trying to please their father, and really only this man pleases his father. Right. His brother is not good at that. So I wonder if you can just talk about setting up that sort of tension and how you came to their backstory.
You know, I guess it's through a little bit through observation. Mm-hmm. I mean, the story is actually based a little bit on a story my grandfather had told me. You know, my grandfather grew up in a log cabin in Pennsylvania in the, you know, early 1900s. And when he was 9 years old, he was taken from school and sent out to the woods with a crosscut saw and an axe and made to cut wood. And he...
Nine years old.
Yeah. Huh. And, his father could be he told me an extremely vicious man, and he said for some reason he focused all of it on my brother, not me, not anyone else. He just, you know, my brother was always the one that seemed to push him over his limit, or somehow he focused on him. And so that's kind of where the idea, and I've observed that pattern too in families, that, you know, there's the good son and the bad son, of course, at least from an outside perspective, right. You know.
Well, one thing that was really just beautifully done is the guilt that the good son has for being just, you know, much more capable of being good and doing what he knew his father wanted, and just seeing that his brother wasn't capable of being that person and feeling guilty about it, but knowing that he wasn't going to be able to help him or make the right choices for him, and choosing, you know, sort of to protect himself. And that was, yeah, that was a very nice tension that was set up.
Yeah, and he, at the same time, he's kind of trying to justify his position too. You know, yeah. he's not shy about saying, you know, his brother makes bad choices.
Yeah.
But I think really at his heart, he does feel that pain over you know, the way his brother's made.
Yeah.
That's different from him.
Right. It's also refreshing when there's a narrator. You know, naturally, we mostly take the side of narrators in stories, I think. And when he's flawed a little bit, and I do think that this is a little bit of a character flaw, that he's not capable of helping his brother more, that's more interesting. This is so much more interesting to me than characters that are just black and white.
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's about dimensionality, I guess. And I don't even know if I'm consciously going, I need to create a character with multiple dimensions, or whether it's just more interesting to me,
yeah,
to try to create someone that has a flaw. I mean, to me, if everything's going well in a story, that's the sign that your reader's going to get bored.
Right.
And trouble makes interest.
Yes.
You know?
Right.
So,
one of the things I find so impressive about your writing is your transitions, right? So going back and forth within a story and picking up threads in a way that one thing doesn't necessarily lead to another, but I'm ready for the next thread every time it comes in. So I was just going to read a few of these. So you read the part that ends, you know, the interstate spoiled it all, which puts us into a past tense mood, and then the next section starts when Dad dreamed up the Museum of the Americas in 1949, just 2 years after my mother died. The whole family thought he was crazy, right? So that brings us so nicely back in time. But then, you know, you give us a little bit of the past, and then there's another new break, and it says, the woman from Illinois climbed out of the wagon and went around to her husband's side, pulled him up out of his seat as his face soured with pain. So there we are, we're transitioning back into the present tense. And throughout this collection, really, I felt that you managed transitions so beautifully. So I wondered if you can talk about what you try to do in these moments.
You know, that's a very complicated thing to think about. But I'll fall back on something with that. At about the same time that I was really starting to write seriously, I got a job at a publishing house in Boston. It was an educational publishing house. And, you know, for about a year and a half, they let me Xerox things. But I wanted to be an editor, you know.
Right.
And so finally they said, well, we're going to give you a chance to be an editor. And at the time, I had already started writing, you know, I'd been writing stories, and I'd been writing a little bit of music journalism for a tiny magazine in Boston. And I you know, I thought, well, I'm a pretty good writer, you know. And so I wrote my first, you know, kind of chapter or assignment of this textbook, and I sent it down to copy edit, you know, and it came back, you know, they use green pencils to mark everything up, and the paper went down white and came back green. And I was floored. I was like, you know, how is it even possible to make this many mistakes. And fortunately, there were a couple of, you know, women in the copy editing department who took me under their wing. And not only would they mark up what I did wrong, but they would take the time to explain to me why my sentence wasn't logical, or why my transition wasn't clear, or why I was leaving people out in the middle of nowhere. And they, you know, well, I perfectly understood what I wanted to communicate as I was writing it, and I understood it why other people wouldn't.
Right.
And so if there's a, I really work hard on those transitions, because from my training as a professional editor, I understand that if you don't, it's going to leave your reader hanging, and they're not going to enjoy that.
Right.
So I guess that's the best explanation I can give.
Right, and there is a little bit of mystery to how, why does it work so well, but it's just writing, I guess, for yourself.
And you only get to see the stories in which I've done that well, so you don't get to see all the ones that I have terrible transitions and I don't,
right.
You know, and I don't, and then the story meanders around in ways that I just can't tame.
Yeah.
So...
You have another story in here called The Truest Curse. And to me, it was so interesting that the same author wrote Museum of the Americas and The Truest Curse. They could not be more different in narrator and in tone and in the backstory of these characters. So The Truest Curse is sort of about, I think they're gypsies, but otherwise they're fortune tellers.
Right.
And so where did that come from?
You know, I lived in Boston for many years, and one day I was kind of just wandering around down by Boston Common, and I went past this, you know, kind of nondescript office building, and up on the second floor was a sign with a palm, you know, a hand, and it said, you know, fortunes and tarot or something, and I thought, you know, I don't really believe in this stuff, but I've never had it done, but, you know, I got a few bucks in my pocket, I'm just going to go up and have it done. So I went upstairs in this kind of this rundown apartment. It was this woman and her daughter was there, kind of sitting there. And, you know, I gave her, I don't know, $5 or $10. And she read my palm and said, you know, just about everything I'd expected that she would say. You know, you have a future that's a little murky, but, you know, here's what might happen. And it didn't really impress me in any way. But I just thought, like, what about a kid who was living in this, you know, situation? What would a kid... think about that, you know? And then I also, at one point in my life, I was working at a residential treatment center for adolescent girls. And this one girl, her life situation just impressed itself on me because her parents had come to America from Greece when they were adults, but she was born in the U.S. And there were all these family conflicts because, you know, what she wanted to be was an American girl, and what her parents wanted her to be was a very prim and proper Greek girl. And so I kind of worked some of that into the story, and that's really what, you know, The Truest Curse. It's about a girl who wants to be an American girl more than anything, but she's kind of held separate from the culture by her family background and the way they make their living.
Right.
So,
and it was this... it was this background that was so colorful and interesting, too, in addition to just, you know, really bringing out the differences between what she wanted and what her parents wanted. It was really fun to read about that.
Oh, thank you.
Culture, yeah. Your titles, I just wanted to know where you find your story titles. Do you enjoy that? Or
no, I don't enjoy
it's
that
a chore.
At all.
That was my
terrible at it.
Oh, I don't think you're terrible at it.
Well, I just have to write titles and titles and titles and titles and titles.
So you're not necessarily mining the narrative for a set of words or something?
Sometimes I am, but I'm not easy to satisfy. But even, you know, a number of the stories in this collection were published even under different titles than they now have, because I just never feel like the titles, you know, some of them, yeah, but like I think the title of The Truest Curse changed 4 or 5 times, and so I was submitting it under, and then, you know, and then I go, you know, I just don't like that title, I'm gonna change it again. And
You're most of these are pretty succinct, I think.
Yeah.
You don't tend to go in for the titles that are like full sentences or something.
Right.
Like that.
Right.
Yeah. And we've talked a little bit about this specifically about a couple stories, but how do you tend to find your way into a story? Does it tend to be something in your life that sparks something, or is it all over the board?
It tends to be something that I've seen, you know, a little something, like the driving by that museum, like getting my palm read, seeing one story in here is about a boy who finds an object, sees a fantastic object floating down a river. And I
right.
once saw a very fantastic object floating down a river.
Did you?
And yeah.
This
and
was a very fantastic object.
Yeah. Mine wasn't quite that fantastic, but it was similar. And so I just get that little thing that gets my mind going. And then it might be quite a while. Before anything comes of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next step is voice. Once I can get the voice, I can pretty much move forward. And if I can't get the voice, I'll really struggle. And it's all about just hearing that person, hearing it.
Does it sneak up on you at moments you don't expect?
Oh, absolutely.
Maybe you'll spend a morning thinking about something, and the next morning you're not thinking about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
In part because I'm not very disciplined sometimes.
And, oh, yeah.
You know, it's just... But, I had the good fortune of driving a lot in my life, you know, mm-hmm. for various reasons. And I do a lot of work in the car, just driving and thinking.
Right.
It's a great place for me to be, where I'm kind of isolated from everything, and I'm prone to distraction, I will say that, and it's hard to find that place where you just have to be locked in for hours, and the car is a place where that happens for me.
So do you carry like a dictaphone or something in case something comes to you?
No, but I will, although I don't do it in Vermont because it's illegal. I use my cell phone.
Yeah.
Before cell phones, I didn't do that a lot. I mean, I've lost a few ideas because of that, because I didn't write them down,
yeah,
more than a few probably. But, you know, if I'm locked in a good space, I mean, I can be literally writing and memorizing lines as I'm driving. And sometimes I'll pull over to rest stop
right.
and write something down just to remind me
Right. Can I ask you to read again?
Sure.
So I want to have a conversation about beginnings of stories. So mm-hmm. I just thought maybe you could start... read the first, maybe page and a half, or stop where it seems like it's a good stopping point in melting.
Sure. Melting. Mr. Schuler and his child bride live at the Igloo Fill and Rest. Thousands of motorists pass the Igloo Fill and Rest every day without stopping. They are too far up the hill on the highway. They are too close to the new hotel and 20-pump gas station. The igloos, cabins $8, two beds, sink, toilet, the sign reads, are closed, except for one of the eight. Mr. Schuler and his child bride live in number 4. At one time, Mr. Robinson, Mr. Schuler's long-dead uncle, tried dressing his pump jockeys in realistic Eskimo clothing. The Igloo Fill and Rest is located 80 miles southeast of Los Angeles. Instead of automobiles lined up at his pumps, Mr. Robinson got ambulances. Now Mr. Robinson is gone. It is just Mr. Schuler and his child bride. Their days vary but are never busy. The evenings are always the same. In the evening, Mr. Schuler's child bride walks through the crumbling asphalt courtyard of the Igloo Fill and Rest. She arches the hot soles of her feet, brushing them over dewy grass blooms that push up through the broken macadam. She walks very gracefully and sways a bit, as if she were singing, but she never sings. She has never heard a song. Mr. Schuler's child bride is deaf and mute. Mr. Schuler never takes walks in the courtyard. He's seen it so many times that it hurts him to have to look at it again, empty and dark. When it's time to close down the Igloo Fill, Mr. Schuler walks out behind Igloo number 4 to the big rusty fuse box nailed to the old leaning over telephone pole, opens it, and smashes down the red-handled breaker switch. When he does this, all the lights in the courtyard go off. All the frogs in the old green water-filled wading pool at the back end of the courtyard stop singing for a few seconds, and the dark is heavy with quiet. After those few seconds of darkness and silence, Mr. Schuler smashes the big breaker switch back on.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I love that. I love that for a few reasons. So I wanted to talk about getting into a story, the beginning of a story, how you help your reader into it, as opposed to how you might get into it yourself, which is what we just talked about. And I'm also curious about that expression, "and his child bride," which is almost like a chorus in the beginning of the story, sort of throughout the story. So let's talk about those things.
Okay, which one? First the beginning?
The beginning, yeah.
You know, I guess I'm just looking for an entrance point that I think is interesting and is going to grab someone's attention right away. However, I will say that I've worked a couple times with the writer Steve Almond, who's just fantastic in the last few summers, and he has really helped to convince me that the kind of idea of, you know, in medias res, you know, opening in the middle of a scene is not always the best option. And sometimes it's helpful to give the reader a little bit of context and a little bit of kind of setting the table before you move into the story. And this is actually a story where I did that, but I wrote it way long before I ever worked with Steve. So I think my openings are changing a little bit, kind of under the influence of that. I see that in a lot of cases, I feel he does have a valid point that authors ask you to start in the middle of something and like you're confused and they're making you work more than you should need to work to start.
So when do you suppose that's a better idea or a worse idea? Is it the strength of the voice that will draw someone in past the point at which they're confused, do you suppose?
Yeah, it's hard. I think it's a case-by-case basis, you know. Yeah. I mean, even after working with Steve, you know, I started a story and finished it, and I realized after I'd done all that, I was just out of Steve's workshop, and I completely ignored his idea, and I started in the middle of things, and I just felt like, you know, that was right for me. But I've written another story since working with Steve where I really do fill in a lot of background stuff at the beginning, so I'm not really sure. I guess I do believe that, you know, he says number one rule is don't confuse the reader, and I think that's a pretty smart way to look at it, you know.
Right.
Because there's a lot of reading choices, and you want people to feel, even if you're opening in scene, you want them to feel like they're in extremely sure hands.
Yeah, yeah. And I also wonder if maybe there's more of a risk when you're working on a novel, because you know where it's going, and it's got a long way to go.
Right.
And so maybe you take more for granted than you can let your reader suffer through. You know?
Right, exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Okay, how about that expression, "and his child bride"?
You know, part of it was stylistic. I mean, at the time that this is an old story. This is an old, old story. And at the time that I was writing and I was reading a lot of stories by Richard Brautigan, and he uses that kind of stylistic repetition and things like that. So I think part of it was imitation, but part of it was also that I knew that the idea of this older man with a quote-unquote child bride was a risky thing. And I wanted to, you know, it's kind of like go big or stay home, you know. Say it over and over. Because what I want you to really think about, you know, in this story, or part of what I want people to think about is the idea that it's really easy to condemn, you know, someone else's relationship, you know, or the way other people live.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's harder, but it may be more rewarding to be accepting of the way, you know, it's a very violent, there's very violence in this story.
Right.
There's violent abuse, you know, really. There's, you know, he's a man, he beats his wife, you know, and causes her to miscarry, and she forgives him,
right.
You know. And, you know, I'm not responsible for making sure that all my characters behave in an optimal way, you know, morally. I don't want to feel responsible for that. I want to try to understand the world that I see in front of me, and I want to try to respond to that world. And I want to show respect toward people, even if I personally think what they're doing is not morally right.
Right.
You know, and so that's part of that repetition. But I do like wordplay. I do like rhythm. I do feel very much that sentence rhythm is important, you know.
Yeah. And you're a musician too, right?
Well, that would be an exaggeration. I do play music, but I love music.
Right,
and I write about music professionally, and I'm a big, big music fan.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I like a musicality to words. You know, I like it when a writer's paying attention to that.
The other thing that strikes me about the expression "and his child bride" is that right away we're expecting that this girl is 13, 14 years old, which she was once, but she's in her late 20s, early 30s.
Right.
And when we realize that, it throws you off because you've already made this opinion about like what you think about this, but actually they've been together a really long time, and she's not leaving of her own accord, you know? And
right.
So it's just very interesting. I think it's
And I think for me, it's like, you know, that's how things happen. You know, when she was 13, you know, people probably talked about that old man and his child bride, and it just, you know, she's going to be the child bride forever in some people's minds.
Right, including maybe his own, because sort of his narrative point of view that we're hearing.
Sure.
So, you have a story called Lucky Duck, Lucky Luck. I tried to write a story several years ago. I did write a story. I wasn't as pleased with it, and I like yours better. But it was about a character who has been unkind in her past, maybe in high school, to another character, to another person.
Right.
And this story did that so well. Anyway, in this story, Lucky Duck, Lucky Luck, a glass eye has quite a lot of importance. And I'm just wondering if we can talk about objects in stories and in fiction.
Yeah.
Choosing objects and what they are, what they come to the meaning that they accumulate.
Yeah, I guess I don't really think about them a lot. Like, I don't write a story and say, oh, I need to put an interesting or a totemic object in there. And I can't even tell you how a glass eye found its way into this story.
Well, it did it very decidedly.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely in there. You know, or how a glass of, you know, a jar of soil, or, you know, any other, an object floating down the river.
Right.
I guess for me, that's what I'm drawn to in a subconscious way, I guess.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I have a new story with a leg in it, with a salted leg. It's a preserved human leg.
Oh.
And a guy's carrying it around with him.
Wow. And that takes up some space, among other things.
Yeah, it does, yeah. And so I'm not sure how these objects find their way in. I mean, this story, I was thinking more, you know, I have a daughter who's 18, and so I got to see, you know, what happens in high schools to girls and with girls, and the kind of mean girl thing. And so that was just on my mind a lot.
Yeah.
Like the cruelty that happens. And I saw it myself, you know, and now, you know, I'm 50 years old, and all the people I went to high school with are 50, you know, 54 years old, whatever. But we were mean to each other, but now all that's behind us, or is it, you know?
Right, right.
And how does that happen, and what do people think about that? And that's kind of what the story's about.
Yeah, and it's nice that it's from the point of view of the person who was not very nice, instead of the victim, because it's, in some ways, it's more interesting to be in the mind of the person who was not very nice and knows it.
Yeah.
I suppose that it would be equally interesting to be in the mind of a victim if you make that, you know, sort of, there's a conflict there.
Yeah, so they're more than a victim.
Right, But so do you think that an object will ever start out really commonplace for you, just something that you happen to put in the story because there's a red waste paper basket in the room and you put it into the room, and then it will start to take on significance as you go?
I don't know.
I
wouldn't rule that out.
I'm putting words in your mouth.
No, I wouldn't rule that out. I guess I don't really think of the object first, you know?
Right. Okay. I mean, clearly with the glass eye, it had more significance from the start.
Sure.
It's not something that was just sitting on the floor.
Yeah.
So, do you mind if I read a short section?
Go for it.
Okay. So, this is from a story called Night Train. It hadn't rained for weeks, and dust hung on the air for long after the truck had stopped. Laid off sawmill and oil field men, half drunk already with beer mugs in their weighty paws and no work in sight, waded through the dust from the back doors of Scotty's Tap to watch the driver and his helper unload. The driver was a gigantic man, With a huge red beard growing down his chest and a clot of snuff in his long, crooked jaw, he jumped down from the truck, yelling as he hit the ground, "Drop that ramp down from the top. Let's get these out of here." His helper unhooked the plank ramp fastened to the back end of the truck and laid it out from the truck bed to the porch of the rooming house. The driver pulled open the truck's back gate with a rusty screech, and I could see the horses. The five of them huddled together in the slatted wooden box, quivering, nervous, popping their hooves against the truck bed, the light that slid in through the slats of the truck, igniting the dust motes the horses stirred. My whole body thrilled as I watched them. I felt their excitement, felt the small explosions of their calves and flanks, the urgent fear that broadened their nostrils. The smell of them caught the air, ammonia, cut hay, and lather. I breathed in deep, and somehow the smell comforted me as if I had known it my whole life. The sensory detail, you know, it's funny. There are a lot of passages in this book that jumped out at me, but this one just stopped me in my tracks, and I went back and read it about four times, and I realized that what it was that this has every one of the senses in it. You see things, you smell things, you hear things. I guess there's no touch, but there's the dust motes in the air. There's this combination of sensory detail. I just thought it was extraordinary. And I wondered as you wrote this, and maybe you won't remember this particular passage, but I wondered if you were writing sensory detail from your imagination or from memory, or if it was from a notebook where you take notes when you observe things, or how that worked.
This was all imagination.
It was just a beautiful passage.
Thank you.
I loved it.
The first writing workshop I was ever in was at the Cambridge Center for Adult Education back in the 80s.
Cambridge, Mass.
And the first night we came into class, the teacher walked in and just said, "Hi, I'm Frank." I think his name's Frank so-and-so. "Write everything that happened since you arrived in this room."
Oh.
And so he had everyone sit and write for a while. And then he said, "Now I want you to circle all the sensory details." And so we circled all the... And he said, "How many people used vision?" And everyone raised their hand. And then he said, "How many people used sound?" Nobody raised their hand. "How many people, you know, use taste?" Nobody raised their hand.
Right.
And so he really, that was a big lesson for me, that, you know, to pay attention to other details.
What a great first class lesson.
Yeah, it was awesome. It was awesome.
Have you used that since then?
I haven't. And that workshop actually, it wasn't that great a workshop really, not because of him. It was jam-packed full of fledgling science fiction writers, and I just had no interest in what they were doing, which is mostly writing about gadgets and people who were one-dimensional and had no interest in anything but gadgets.
It's such a shame because I think science fiction can be so wonderful.
Yeah, I just read a great anthology of science fiction war stories that was published in Vermont recently, and I will say that, you know, they did a nice job on it, and it... what I love about the stories, and I'm not a big reader of science fiction, but I did love these stories because they were about people in moral dilemmas and the influence of technology and how it changes human responsibility.
So what's the title of that one? Do you know?
No, jeepers. One of the editors is Andrew Liptak.
Okay.
And he is somehow affiliated with Norwich. And then there's another guy from Burlington. I can send you that information.
Yeah,
you can share it some other time. You might want to have them on your show, actually,
yeah,
because it's a great little anthology.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Super. You have a lovely moment in the story Night Train, which is what this story was also. A little bit later, maybe a page or two later in this story, you have a father walk up behind his son who's watching these horses, right? And he pulls him in for a hug and a kind of playful ruffle of his hair. And I read that and I thought, boy, you know, I'm not sure I read that many fathers hugging sons in stories, you know, which is, I mean, maybe that's just kind of a random comment, but it was a nice moment in this story. Do you think about stuff like that when you're writing those sorts of moments? Like, are you aware of, like, this is an unusual moment
in
a story?
I am very much aware of that kind of stuff. And I think one big reason is that, and a very big influence on me, and particularly when I was first becoming a writer, was Cormac McCarthy.
Mm.
You know, in Cormac, there's not a lot of explanation about what's going on in people's heads. You know, they're
right.
men, and it's all about the actions that they take. All emotion is expressed through action.
Like Carver does that.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be a long explanation about why a father loves a son. You know, it can be 20 days of silence and then a pat on the shoulder that means everything.
Yeah.
You know, and I find these moments really impactful. You know, there's just such a huge difference, I think, between male writing and female writing in a lot of cases, you know.
Mm-hmm.
My partner Deb is a nonfiction writer, but, you know, I'm pulling my hair out trying to do the emotional and kind of psychological work that's happening in her work, you know, that's the kind of insight and thought processing and kind of, you know, interior monologue that I would kill to have.
Right.
You know, it's so hard for me. But I also like the idea of things that don't have to be explained. You know,
right.
when that dad hugs his kid, you know, what I don't have anything more as a writer to say about that.
The other thing that was interesting was that the father in that moment, he was not endearing himself to me. He was being a little bit critical of the horses, right? So the son is like, they're pretty horses, is what I think. And Papa chuckled, to a starved coyote, he said, maybe.
Yeah.
So, like, right there, I'm like, yeah, you know, that's not nice. And then he pulls his kid in for a hug, and I'm like, oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
So it's this wonderful moment where, as a reader, I'm being kind of tossed around a little bit, and I'm being made to see real life everywhere instead of cliche. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I grew up in northern Pennsylvania. It's a very rural culture. And a culture in which storytelling plays a big role. I mean, I first learned to tell stories when I was 5, and my dad was at the bar every day after work, and I would go to the bar and sit at the bar and drink orange pop and listen to the guys tell hunting and fishing stories. But a big part of that is this joking and kind of busting chops that's happening constantly, you know. So when, you know, the way that you say that you love someone, you know, because it's a very kind of macho in a way culture, you can't say you love someone, but you can say, you know, you're such an idiot,
right?
You know,
right.
Or you can say, you know, those horses are the rattiest horses I've ever seen, you know. And so that's kind of the way it works in that place, and that's where a lot of my work comes from, is these moments that. And I once had a girlfriend, you know, got really pissed at me because, you know, when I brought her home for the weekend from college, and I immediately switch back to speaking my first language, which is that language, and I'm busting on her. And she's like, why are you being so mean to me?
Yeah.
You know, what is up with you? You know, and
right.
and it's hard for someone outside. It's hard to see how it works a lot of the time.
Right, yeah.
You know?
That's like when I went to visit my college roommate, and her family had a very Italian sensibility, and everybody was just screaming at each other all the time, but with great love, and I was so confused.
Yeah,
I was like,
exactly.
What's
sure.
going on?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you talk about your writing program, Writers for Recovery?
Sure. Writers for Recovery came out of, maybe I should explain what it is first. Writers for Recovery is a series of writing workshops for people who are in recovery from substance abuse, or people who have family members who are in recovery or even still using.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been meeting in Burlington at the Turning Point Center on Wednesday nights, Burlington, Vermont, since for about 9 or 10 months. It's an offshoot, and it's supported by Kingdom County Productions.
Mm. That's Jay Craven's.
Jay Craven and Bess O'Brien. And Bess produced a fantastic movie called The Hungry Heart that's about young recovering opiate addicts in Vermont, in rural Vermont, in St. Albans. The movie's fantastic. If you haven't seen it, you should go see it. Everyone should go see it. And it's really changed the dialogue about addiction in Vermont and in other places, too. 2 years later, Bess is now playing it all over the Northeast and mm-hmm. even beyond that. And Bess wanted to try to give a little bit back to the community that had helped her make this film. You know, it's tough for someone who's an addict to come on camera and say, you know, I'm a recovering heroin addict, you know, because there are risks in doing that. On the other hand, there are extreme benefits in being public, going public about it and reducing the stigma. So Bess, several summers ago, decided to run an 8-week workshop up in St. Albans for recovering addicts in the arts. So I taught writing. Erica Heilman, who's a great radio producer, taught radio. And we had a photography person and a theater person, and it was awesome. And then, but there was something about the writing, I think, for Bess that really, people wrote tremendous stuff. And so she got some funding and she called me up and said, do you want to do Writers for Recovery? And we've been doing it for, you know, about 9 months. It's been tremendous.
How many people come?
Anywhere from, say, 5 to 12 people okay. per week.
Yeah.
And a variety of ages and a variety of backgrounds. Some people are very, very new to recovery, just a few months even. Some people have been in recovery for decades.
Okay.
But they find it extremely valuable, I think. We've really built some community around it.
What are you doing? Are you writing in the workshop, or are you?
Yes, almost all of it takes place in the workshop. I give a quick writing prompt, and literally I say, you have 7 minutes, go.
Okay.
And then we read, at the end of 7 minutes, we read our work, and there's no obligation to read, there's no obligation to write, but if you want to, you can share, and then we talk about it. And so sometimes I ask people to write about really heavy topics. You know, we did a prompt called, this is all I remember from that night.
Mm.
And people wrote about, you know, a really terrible night in their lives when, you know, something went badly wrong. And, you know, and sometimes we do fun things. You know, I'll go in and just say, here's a first line from a short story that was published in the New Yorker this week. You write the rest of the story, you know. And I can't tell you how great it's been for me to just watch these people.
Yeah.
Watch incredible writers emerge from the most, you know, unbelievable circumstances. Have people come up to me and say, this has done more for me in 10 weeks than 3 years of therapy.
Hmm.
We had one person in particular on the first night. He had post-traumatic stress. He was involved in a very terrible situation where a friend of his committed suicide with a gun.
Hmm.
And he'd never been able to tell his therapist about it. He had post-traumatic stress. He was very shy to begin with. The first night of the class, he could barely say his name. The third night of the class, he wrote about that incident and read it out loud.
Wow.
The fifth, probably, night of the class, he got interviewed by the Burlington Free Press and agreed to have that story published. And probably the 10th week of the class, he went live with me on WCAX-TV and did a live TV interview.
Wow.
And that's the kind of thing that's been happening.
Wow.
So we're very excited, and we're even more excited that we have just received some funding from the Vermont Department of Corrections, and we're going to be extending to 4 more locations: Barre, Vermont, at the Turning Point Community Center; St. Johnsbury, at the Turning Point Community Center; at the St. Johnsbury Men's Work Camp, which is a correctional facility; and at the Newport Prison, which is another correctional facility.
Now, are any of your students going to teach some of these, or are you going to teach some of these?
I'm going to teach 3 more of the 4, and Bess O'Brien is going to teach a 4th.
Okay.
And also, we've received funding to produce a soft cover anthology of our work.
Oh, that's
so
great.
We'll be coming out with a book of student work. And incidentally, if people want to know more about that, they can go to writersforrecovery.org.
Okay, and that's just the local group?
Yeah.
Okay.
Writers for Recovery right now is us in Vermont, but we... I mean, I'm really starting to realize the potential for this thing to grow and to help people, and it's been fantastic for me. I can't tell you how happy it makes me to just be a part of this, and it's thrilling. It's completely thrilling.
That's great. So, with all your free time, what are you writing now?
I'm working on new stories. I have probably 5 or 6 toward a new collection, and I'm happy with what I have so far, but I'm continuing to struggle on a regular basis to, you know, get things done. It's not easy. I have a new novel I'm working on, which is currently driving me crazy, installed at about 130 pages. Mm. And so I'm working on those two things. I'm actually writing a small book of writing prompts. Mm-hmm. I've done a lot of work with my partner, Deb Fleischman, in something called Write Mondays, which is writing workshops for middle and high school students, middle school and high school. And so we've been using a prompt-based thing for that, too. And since I have a background in writing education, I'm going to write and publish a little ebook of writing prompts for middle and high school teachers.
Oh, that's great.
So that's in the works. And then I'd like to follow with one, with some kind of a guide to setting up a Writers for Recovery group with some prompts. And because I really feel like this model could be multiplied.
Sure.
And, there's not enough of me to do it all.
Yeah.
So I'm working on that. And I'm continuing, I do a lot of book editing. I've got a couple books I'm editing right now. I'm working with a couple private writing students, mm-hmm. and so I'm pretty busy.
Yeah, I mean, sounds
pretty
like
busy.
It. Yeah,
but I like it. I love my freelance life. I never want to have to go and work 9 to 5 and sit in meetings all day ever again.
Right. So, how was the experience of publishing Museum of the Americas? How did you find your press? I know it's Fulmite Press in Burlington.
Well, I had been. I had two novels, and like I said, I had an agent who sent them around to the kind of major publishers where, you get money and therefore your agent gets money, and so an agent's interested in that.
Right.
And when they didn't get picked, when the books didn't get picked up, I have continued to send them out to, indie and new publishers, and so I became aware of this press in Burlington called Fomite, and I sent them, some part of a novel, and they said, great, we like it, send the rest. And then they said, this novel isn't quite our thing, but do you have anything else? And I said, and I had put my story collection together and I already entered it in a couple of contests. And so I said, well, I've got the story collection, and I sent it to them. And literally within 48 hours, I got an email back saying, we love this.
Yeah.
We love this.
Yeah.
And we want to publish it. So I was a Fomite Press author.
Yeah.
And
they are doing a lot.
They're doing a lot.
They're doing great stuff.
They're doing great stuff. And, it's a labor of love for them. I know they're not getting rich doing it, but, they're really filling a space,
yeah.
And that's their goal, is to kind of acquire work that maybe may not be as lucrative to publish for a big publisher, so that's getting ignored but deserves an audience. And that's, it's been great working with them. It's hard when you have that small press behind you, because they can't afford to do a lot of work for you, and so you have to do a lot of things yourself. And you probably know this from your own book that So I've really done a ton of work to just try to get this book out there and whatever. But on the other hand, I've met a lot of really cool people.
Yeah.
And I've had a good time and whatever, and I have a book in print.
You had a pop-up museum that you took around with you. That was fun.
Well, the Museum of the Americas, the title story is set in a little roadside museum, and that's something that's kind of a hobby of mine, actually. I have a big vintage toothbrush collection, and at one point I had a dream of creating a small toothbrush museum when I had a house and land, which I don't have anymore. And so I'm fascinated by that. And I thought, what would be a cool way to maybe attract some attention to this book? And I said, well, I could do a pop-up museum where people can bring in items of their own to a bookstore, and we'll give them a little card to fill out, and we can have a museum for a night. So we did that in a few places. And then I actually went and did a tiny museum tour where I've read at a few tiny museums in Massachusetts and Vermont, and that's been really fun, too.
That's great. Did you go to the Montshire?
No, I didn't. I went to the Museum of Everyday Life in Glover, which is fantastic. I went to the Madsonian Museum of Industrial Design in Waitsfield.
Okay.
I went to the Main Street Museum in White River Junction. And I went to the Museum of Bad Art in Somerville, Massachusetts.
That's awesome.
So it was very fun.
Yeah. Great. All right, I'm going to come full circle and read a quote from Museum of the Americas, the story of Museum of the Americas. Why people take the hard road is a mystery to me. That's a quote that the narrator, he's speaking about his brother. Why people take the hard road is a mystery to me. I love this line. It reminded me of great characters, many of whom do take the hard road, which is why they're more interesting to us. But also writing is the hard road. So I just thought we could finish by talking about that line.
Yeah, I'm attracted to those people that take the hard road. There's a story in here called Certain Miracles, and my dad worked at a factory, at an Ethan Allen factory his whole life. He had an eighth grade education. He was a drinker. He didn't always have the easiest life, but he was a good guy. And one night, it was on Christmas Eve, a car pulled up in front of our house, and in it was a kid who'd worked with my dad at the factory. He was 18 years old. He had one kid, a young baby. He had a pregnant wife a German Shepherd, and everything they owned, packed in a car on New Year's Eve to drive from northern Pennsylvania to Knoxville, Tennessee, to get a dishwashing job.
Wow.
Or on Christmas. Did I say New Year's Eve? Christmas Eve.
Christmas Eve, okay.
And it broke my heart.
Yeah.
You know? Why do people take the hard road?
Yeah.
But it's an interesting road. And so, you know, those are the kind of people I'm interested in, you know. And I grew up around a lot of those people, you know, and I've been that person, you know. I mean, one of the reasons I'm in Writers for Recovery is because I had a problem with drinking and drugs. And, you know, I took the hard road. Why I did it, I have no idea. But, well, I do have an idea, I should say. But, you know, I could have taken an easier road, and I didn't.
Right, yeah.
And it's interesting to me.
Yeah,
so
definitely. Well, I just want to reiterate, the title is Museum of the Americas by Gary Lee Miller, Stories. Fomite Press published it. Thank you so much for speaking.
Thanks so much. It's been fantastic.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Gary Lee Miller. You can learn more about his work at his website, GaryLeeMiller.com, and that's L-E-E. The name Lee in the middle there. Hopefully in the near future, Gary will make more appearances on Write the Book, as I've been looking for a little help here, and he's expressed interest. He's an intelligent reader with a great voice, so I can't think of a better combination for the show, and I hope that you'll be hearing more from him. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Main Street Landing, creating places for people to work, play, entertain, meet, eat, and greet on Burlington's beautiful waterfront. Main Street Landing rents office and retail space, as well as daily rentals for meetings, events, and performances in their Performing Arts Center. Contact Melinda at 802-864-7999, or you can go to mainstreetlanding.com for more information. And by Calamity and Crows Trading Post, twisting fresh tie-dyes for individuals, businesses, and organizations with standards like eyeballs, Jerry Bears, peace signs, and their signature tie-dyed mule. Custom artisan tie-dyes that rock. Contact Calamity and Crows Trading Post on Facebook. All right, so this week's Write the Book prompt, I have a few of them, actually, and they were suggested by my guest, Gary Lee Miller. They are exercises that he has used in his work with Writers for Recovery. Gary refers to these as positioned prompts, or prompts that give writers a specific, unique starting place to help get them going. The first one is, here's exactly what happened. The second is, she was just a block from her house when she found the blue envelope on the sidewalk. And the third is, in the beginning, all I wanted was a normal life. So start with any of those sentences and see where it goes. Gary also shared a fun exercise that he uses sometimes in his classes for kids. It's called the never-ending sentence. That one I don't have time to do full justice to right now. I'm going to just share it on the podcast site. So those are the prompts for today. Good luck with these prompts, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know. They can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. And you can also access the podcast and my new blog, The Silent G, by going to my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. And on that blog, I sometimes will do the prompts that I announce on the show. I haven't done it in a little while. I need to get back over there. If you have a guest to suggest, comments about the show, or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And then finally, do remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, Burlington, Vermont.